Hey, I wanted to jump in here and let you know that we have an introductory pricing going on right now up until May 18th. And what this is I have taken my courses and combined them all into a Move Better bundle. So you're going to be working on your feet, you're going to be working on your posture, and you're going to be working on your core, pelvic floor, all of those things. And you can save big right now. I am selling this for 50% off. So head to movingthroughmidlife.com, click on the Work With Me link. It is the Moving Through Midlife program, your Move Better bundle, where you can start working on feeling better in your body. You also then get access to workouts, recipe guides, live sessions with me and live classes with me throughout the month. So head to movingthroughmidlife.com, click on the Move With Me link, enter intro, and that will give you 50% off. I'm looking forward to it.
Welcome to Raising Healthy Humans, a podcast created for busy moms, where you can easily find info on health and wellness for your family. Join Courtney, a health coach, movement and posture specialist, and founder of FormFit, an active and supportive community where she helps busy moms move more. Here on Raising Healthy Humans podcast, she shares personal life experiences, training, knowledge, and conversations with other health and wellness experts so you can raise healthy humans.
Today, I am speaking with Susan Salinger, the author of Sidelined: How Women Manage and Mismanage Their Health, about what we can do to ensure that we are not putting ourselves on the back burner, to make sure that we are asking the right questions of our healthcare providers, and ultimately taking ownership of our health. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Susan. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fine, and thank you so much for having me.
Of course. I'm excited to be able to speak with you. You want to help women take ownership of their own health. Can you tell me about this? Why did you make this decision? Why are you wanting to help them so much?
Because I did some studying when I retired and I went back to school, and I learned that there was so much information. I took some anthropology classes and learned that there was so much information about women's health that women didn't know. Academics tend to write for each other. And so I thought, I want to get some of this information out there so that women can really take charge of their health. I did not know, for example, that we're misdiagnosed 20 to 30% more than men are. You know, that's a big deal. And I wanted to help women really understand how to get an accurate diagnosis, some of the pitfalls that an accurate diagnosis can reveal, et cetera. So it was really a journey for me.
Okay, let me ask you a question. With these diagnoses or these misdiagnoses, does it tend to be more often, and maybe you don't have the answer for this, more often men, male doctors or female doctors? Is there a noticeable difference between a male doctor and female doctor with these diagnoses?
I don't know. You know, when I did the research, it took me about 10 years to write the book. When I did the research, the literature was sort of mixed upon whether women were better off with women doctors or male doctors. And now it seems as if we're better off with women doctors. But I don't know if that's really because we're happier with women doctors. I don't know if that's because the diagnoses are more accurate. I can't tell you. So I guess I don't know. But yes, there wasn't much evidence one way or the other at the time I did my stuff.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just wondering, you know, because maybe women are more apt to, I'm not saying this is actual information. Yeah. I'm just saying, like, you know, are they more apt to listen because they may be going through similar situations, that type of thing. So
I think they're probably less quick to write off our symptoms as depression. I do think that.
Okay.
Except that women do suffer from depression more than men do. So that when you get a when you get a diagnosis like that, it doesn't necessarily mean your doctor's blowing you off. So I mean, it's a hard call. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and when you work, because you've written a book about this, right? Yeah. There's something specific that you were working with. Was it, like you mentioned, depression? Was it heart disease? Was it perimenopause and menopause? Was there anything specific you were looking for when you wrote this, or is it just overall health?
Well, the book is about overall health. And the way it actually started was that I had taken, as I said, some anthropology classes. And for one of my classes, I did a project on women with hysterectomies. And okay. I interviewed, I don't remember, several women. And I was very surprised that many of them had agreed to the surgery, even though they didn't need it. And so they felt they didn't need it. Whether or not they needed it, I have no way of knowing, nor frankly did they, because they didn't really talk to their doctors about it. But nevertheless, they had agreed to it anyway. And something similar had happened to me years and years and years ago, like 40 years ago, where I didn't have a hysterectomy, but I also agreed to some exploratory surgery that I didn't think I needed. And that kind of, so the project I did for school raised all of those old feelings I had about why did I do this. And I began to wonder how women make medical decisions. And that's kind of what the book started out to, and it does answer to a certain extent. We all make our decisions for different reasons. But I interviewed about 50, 60 women and found some, all of whom had different diseases. And then I just extrapolated some behaviors that they had in common that I thought did a and they agreed actually, did a disservice to their health. So that's kind of how I got all into this.
Okay, so let's talk into that. What were some of the common things that you were noticing with women?
The first thing that actually struck me, and this will be of particular interest to your audience, understanding it as somewhat like I read your stuff, women put themselves last, and we take care of ourselves last. And I think that when we do that, I think we forget the disservice not only we're doing to ourselves, but to our families. There was a fun study done where researchers gave a bunch of women a list of five things to prioritize, you know, who or what would they take care of first? And the first thing we take care of is our children. The second thing is our pets. I loved that.
Wow.
Isn't that funny? The third thing is our elderly parents. And being elderly myself, I could just see my kids saying, sorry, Mom, we know you need to go to emergency, but Fida here is really having trouble. And I'm thinking like, really? You know, but the fourth thing we take care of is our significant others. And then the fifth thing, last but not least, is ourselves. And I think that really was, that did surprise me, because I don't know how we can take care of others when we don't feel good. I mean, we have no energy, we're irritable, we're tired, whatever. And I think it makes it very difficult to do the best caretaking that women can do.
Well, and I think, isn't that like our nurturing, like that is what we do, is we want to nurture and help those around us. I'm thinking of a specific thing that my husband tells me all the time, and it just flusters me so much. So he'll make breakfast, lunch, dinner, whatever. He usually makes breakfast. I make dinner. But he'll always say to me, like, I am no good to the people around me if I don't eat first. Because I'll get frustrated. I'm like, you went off and ate, and you didn't even ensure that, you know, the kids had their food or the animals had their food. And I'm the exact opposite. I won't eat. I make sure my daughter has her food all situated. All the animals have their food before I'll eat. But I mean, this kind of ties into what you're talking about, is just how things are different, how we look at things differently. And do you know?
I think that's it's very true what you're saying, but it's a little bit different because the point is you do eat. You may eat last, but you don't not eat.
Right. But taking care of others before we take care of ourselves. So then that ties into that whole taking care, like getting our children to the doctors. And I do it myself all the time. I'm like, I have to hold off because they have doctor's appointments that I need to get them to first.
Yes. Yes. And I think that that's true of all of us. And what I'm saying, or not all of us, but most of us. And I think what I'm saying is we really need to watch it. We need to make sure that we don't not go to the doctor and we don't put it off because we're taking care of our families and there's lunches to make and projects at work and all of those things, because that's when little issues can become big issues. There's a story in my book about a woman I interviewed who had a mammogram and was called to go back for a second one. And she had an appointment for a follow-up, but you know, she had no childcare. Her husband was out of town. It was raining, one of those. And she ended up with stage 3 breast cancer because she just never made it back because. And right. That's what I'm saying is the issue.
Gotcha.
And I think we're socialized to take care of others too. I don't know how biological it is, probably somewhat evolutionary, but it's certainly a socialization issue and cultural issue as well. And I wanted to give women not only the motivation, but the tools to take care of themselves. And my book is full of, you know, how to's, what to do, questions to ask, all those kinds of things, so that when you do go in, you get the best care possible.
Okay. Can you give us, let's say, a tool just to work? Do you have any tools to get us to get past this feeling of, you know, I can't do this because I have all these other things that I have to do?
The only tool I can offer for that, because that's a tough one. It's not a specific thing, but I think the best thing to do and the only thing to do is to really be aware that this is a healthcare problem that women have, that we do tend to put off going to the doctor, that as a result, we do expose ourselves to the possibility that a small problem like this woman's breast lump can become a big problem like stage 3, and don't do it. Snap out of it is what I want to say. Just be aware of it. And if you're aware of it, I think you'll take care of yourself a little bit better.
Well, and also I'm thinking about like so we've scheduled the appointment, but how many of us prepare for that appointment?
That is a great question and one of my favorite questions. For that, I have specific tools. And a lot of us don't prepare for some of the same reasons. We don't have time. We're just so glad to get ourselves there that we don't think it through. But there are some definite things that you can do to prepare for the visit, and it will help you get a more accurate diagnosis. The first thing I think you need to do is make a list of the things that you want to talk about, your symptoms, and prioritize them. And by a list, I mean a written list, or I don't care if you put it in your phone or use an old-fashioned pencil, you know, those yellow things. But I think it's really important to make a list. Because if you're like me and you get anxious, I forget half of what I want to talk about. In fact, I was on a show recently with the doctor, and she was saying she really appreciates the list. Because, well, step number 2, and I'll go back to my story in a minute, is don't, whatever you do, come up with a new problem as the doctor is leaving the room. And this doctor was saying her patient didn't have a list. And as she was leaving the room and the visit she thought was over, the woman said, oh, and I have this little mole on my back. Well, that was the most important thing the woman said in the whole. So that she had to turn around and go back. And, you know, the doctor was saying that if her patient had had a list, she would have read the list, she would have seen mole, and she would have done that first. Mm. So it's helpful to the doctor if you have a list. So that's the first thing. And I think it's also really important to ask for the clinical name of your diagnosis, so that you want the doctor to write it out for you, so you can go home and look it up on Google or whatever you do, and make sure that you're comfortable with it. You want to make sure that the symptoms you describe really fit the diagnosis that the doctor gave you. And I can talk later if you want about how tough an accurate diagnosis is. I mean, it doesn't mean your doctor's incompetent. It just means that he has or she has a lot of choices of illnesses, and you want to make sure that you feel it's a good fit. And then you need to repeat back in your own words what you hear the doctor say. This is going to blow you away. Only about 15% of women will tell the doctor when they don't understand something. But that means that 85% of us don't. I mean, that's a hell of a lot of women that go out of the doctor's office not really knowing what they've or understanding what they've heard. And I think that that's a critical statistic. And if you repeat back in your own words, your doctor has a chance to say, no, that's not what I meant. I mean, maybe he or she just didn't say it articulately, or they can confirm, correct, whatever. There's a chance for a better understanding. And last but not least, take somebody with you, just so if you get anxious, you have another pair of ears there. Those were a lot of tips. I don't mean to talk so much, but they're really
That's great. Well, and even in today's age, even if you can't have someone with you, maybe having the opportunity to record what's being said, as long as the doctor's okay with that, so that you have that information to then take home and listen to it again.
Let me just tell you a quick story about how important I think research can be. And incidentally, just as a sidebar, my book has a great resource section in the back. I've done your research for you. I've told you where to go to look up a prescription or where to go to look up a diagnosis. I mean, for those of you that do decide to buy the book, go to the resource section. It's important. But anyway, I'm on Lexapro. I recently lost my husband, and so I've been on Lexapro for depression. And I woke up, I'm one of the lucky people. I've never had pain, just don't get it. So I woke up with a very sore thumb one day. And, you know, because I'm a bit of a hypochondriac, which you become after you start researching medical stuff, I decided it was probably, I don't know, brain cancer that had metastasized to my thumb. I mean, you know, so after about, I know it's nutty, but there it is. What can I tell you?
You sound like my husband.
Oh, it's just who I am. So I waited a couple of weeks. I mean, I'm not psychotic. I'm just neurotic, but the pain was still there. So I went to the thumb doctor. I went to a hand doctor. And, you know, she said, you know, you are 80 years old. It's a little bit of arthritis. Get used to it. That's what happens as you age. So she prescribed some medication for my thumb. And I said, you know, I'm on Lexapro. Do the two things, are they counterintuitive or whatever? Do they interact in a poor way? And she said, no, not at all. Just, you know, go home, take it. Your thumb will be fine. So because of my book, I went home and I looked it up. And she was mostly right, except that the medication had a 1% chance of a brain bleed. So that's 99% chance I wouldn't get it. But what if I was in the 1%? And we're talking about a sore thumb versus a brain bleed. So when you really start to assess the risks and the benefits, I just threw out the prescription and my thumb healed and it's been, you know, been fine ever after. But seriously, I would not have taken a risk that serious for something as minor as a slightly arthritic thumb. Sometimes you don't have a choice. I mean, I want to be clear about that.
Right, but, right.
I would have preferred to have a sore thumb my whole life than a small brain bleed. Thank you very much.
Well, and I love what you said there, because that's one thing that I try to relay to listeners is just being an advocate for your own health and not just relying specifically, not that there was anything wrong with what the doctor recommended, but being an advocate for yourself to decide for yourself, not just assuming the doctor knows best.
Right.
And taking it again, like you said, not meaning that some medications aren't imperative, but also understanding that you have to weigh your own options with what you're needing these medications or whatever for treatments, surgeries, all of it.
And quite honestly, it depends upon the degree of pain in your thumb. You know, I mean, for everybody, it's different. But let's talk about second opinions a minute, because I want to bounce off what you said about trusting the doctor. Let me just go back to how difficult it is for any doctor. And I mean, whether they're incredibly competent or even incredibly incompetent, which also happens. But there's about 20,000, 30,000 diseases out there. And those are just the ones we know about. many of them share similar symptoms. So when you go to the doctor and you say, oh my goodness, I'm tired, I just kind of ache, and I'm, you know, I have no appetite, I'm depressed, etc., it, those symptoms will fit, you know, 19,000 of the 20,000. So for the doctor, it can be like most of the time, like looking for a needle in a haystack.
Right.
And what we have to realize and really remember is that there's a perceptual bias really, really plays a part. We see what we expect to see. So the same symptoms can seem like stress to a psychologist, stomach issues to a gastroenterologist, joint issues to a rheumatologist. So it's important, particularly if your diagnosis is significant, is a serious one, and particularly if the treatment for it is surgery or a serious drug, you really want to get a second opinion. And women hesitate to do that because, like you were saying, we want to take care of the doctor. I mean, it kind of goes back to that. We don't want to be rude. We want to, you know, he's the professional. We don't want to hurt his or her feelings, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm there's a very important chapter in the book on second opinions because I really, really, really seriously believe in them. A lot of the women I talked to felt that they were challenging their doctor with the second opinion. And I'd like to reframe it to say that you're confirming what your doctor diagnosed. It's not necessarily a challenge. It isn't a challenge. It's you're being careful. You're taking care of yourself.
Right. Well, and we have a story. I have a story where my husband and I had something where I said, we need a second opinion because they were getting ready to cut his face open where there's lots of nerves there. And they said that he could end up unable to move one side of his face due to something. And we got a second opinion. And the doctor basically told us he had like this lump and, the doctor said, stop pissing it off. Stop touching it. And he stopped touching it and it went away.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. And this other one wanted to do surgery because it kept coming back. They, you know, like it wasn't cancerous, but it was inconclusive. So he's like, let's just get it out of there. And the other one's like, no, just leave it alone. You're making it angry. Just leave it alone. So,
yeah,
I mean, these things can happen. And like you said, it doesn't mean that you're going against what they're saying. Like, I'm sure just as many, just like I mentioned this one thing, there's as many stories in the alternate that, yes, they confirmed what the first person said and recommended whatever.
Years ago when my daughter was young, she had TMJ, which is where your jaw cracks. Okay, I can see you're nodding, so you know what it is.
Yep.
But at the time, we must have had seven opinions talking about second opinions because there was a real split in the TMJ community. And one group said, you absolutely have to have surgery. And the other group said, don't have surgery no matter what you do. And thank God we decided not to. We were just, in fact, I canceled the surgery the night before. I got scared and I thought, forget this. And as it turns out, what they were replacing or putting in the jawbone to keep it from cracking was disfigured just about 100% of the people that had the surgery. Can you believe that?
Oh, goodness.
I know. Can you believe it? I mean, so I was thankful that we had gotten so many opinions, and I knew that the conflict was within the community. And I thought, if they're not sure, like you said, there's a lot of nerves and stuff in there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had some terrible things said to me. I mean, one doctor who wanted me to have the surgery said, you know, if you don't have the surgery, you need to consider your hostile feelings towards your daughter. The doctor that want me to have the surgery didn't, you know, said, why as parents do we always need our children to be perfect? So everybody was mad at me. And
one way or the other.
Yeah, right. So well, now I know.
Yeah, and that's the advocacy for yourself. Only you really ultimately know what is best for you.
Exactly. And I was not, as the mother, I was not comfortable.
You mentioned going back to the like misdiagnosis and everything. You mentioned that there was something you wanted to go further in on. Do you remember?
Yes, I did already. I wanted to talk about how easy it is for a doctor to make a misdiagnosis.
Oh, okay. What can we do? You mentioned like the hysterectomies, the women in the hysterectomies, and learning that maybe or maybe they didn't need them. What can we do to kind of help, other than getting a second diagnosis, you know, to double check with that? Is there anything else that you recommend that we do? I know you Yes. mentioned Google, looking into it a little bit further.
Yeah, looking into it. It's interesting because actually the women that I did interview who did have the hysterectomy, many of them never realized that there could be emotional repercussions, particularly to a hysterectomy as well. And that was because they hadn't researched, I want to go back to that, but also they hadn't researched the full picture. They all knew that they researched, I guess I want to say, the physiological or organic, the side effects, but not the emotional ones. So I think it's really important when you do your research and when you think about either taking a particular medication, like the Lexapro I'm on, for example, or just having surgery, your emotions are affected. And we sort of separate our minds and bodies. The women I met simply wanted the fastest recovery that they could have, so they completely did all they looked up how long it would take them to get back on the treadmill or whatever, but they didn't look up the emotional repercussions. And I think that that's a serious thing to overlook. You know, it's funny, our minds and bodies are so connected, and researchers did a great study about how important our body is to what we think. For example, they took two groups of students, put them in two different rooms. One group they gave hot coffee, one group they gave iced coffee, and then they gave them the same script to each group and said, what do you think of this person? And the group with the warm coffee thought the person was much nicer than the group with the cold coffee. It just made a difference in how they looked at this particular fictitious person. It was really interesting.
That's very interesting.
I know, isn't it? We're so affected. And let me just, it goes the other way, because our body really affects our minds. I'm sorry, I want to say it the other way. Our minds really affect our bodies. Different researchers, but very similar. They took two groups of students and put them in a room. And they gave, I don't know what they, I'm trying to remember what they did. Oh, I know. They asked one group to write about a time when they felt socially rejected, and another group to write about a time when they felt socially accepted. And the group that felt socially accepted judged the room to be 5 degrees warmer than the group that was socially accepted, because they were feeling warm. The researchers said they were feeling warm and fuzzy, so that they thought the room was warmer than the other group. It's fascinating to me. It's just fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, well, and that's also like the whole with the pain and understanding how pain in the body,
yes,
it would be the same type of thing. Like sometimes pain is more of a perception. It's more of a neuro response than actual, the sensation.
There's been a lot of research on that. And look at placebos. For those of you that don't know, a placebo is no medication of any kind. Your doctor's giving you a sugar pill. With your permission, you know it's a sugar pill. And it still will help you. It will, for some people. I mean, it can reduce pain. It can lower blood pressure. And there's no chemicals in it whatsoever. It's fascinating. It's just fascinating. So that's why you really have to look at your emotional, at the emotional after effects, as well as the physiological ones.
Okay. Leading into a question I have for you would be, with these women who feel like there's something wrong and they go to the doctor and maybe the doctor brushes it off.
Right.
What can they do? You know, are you recommending a second opinion or diving deeper? Because like you said, there's so many things. I mean, I can think of just how many things we deal with on a hormonal level that our doctors might be just like, oh, you know, it's hormones. It's that stage of your life. Or like you mentioned with your thumb, oh, it's your age. You're dealing with arthritis.
And I want to be careful here, and I'll tell you why. First of all, very important to realize that women do suffer from depression and anxiety more than men do. So again, your doctor isn't necessarily blowing you off. They may be. And sometimes they are. I don't want in any way negate that. But so the first thing you have to think to yourself is it true? Well, how do I know this? And I can't answer that. That's something you have to go deep inside. And I will tell you, the second thing that's really important to know is it depends on your symptoms. For example, if you think you're having a heart attack and the doctor says, no, those pains are just stress, I would not accept that diagnosis. Because if the doctor's wrong, the alternative is too serious just for me to blow it off. And that happens a lot. In fact, just again, as a sidebar, my advice to any woman that is told that and has chest pain to go right to the emergency room and don't leave the emergency room without an EKG. You insist on electrocardiogram because that's the only way to know if you're having a heart attack. And so many times they will send women home with saying it's just a stomach ache and you're upset. So don't let them blow you off. That's really important. But what you can do, and this is important to realize too, is that women talk to doctors differently from how men do. We describe our symptoms differently. And I'm as guilty of this as anybody. We tell the doctor the whole story. Men are much more succinct. You're laughing because it's so true. But men are succinct. They're objective. They go in and they say, I have a sore throat. I don't do that. I have a sore throat and I'm so tired and it hurts me and I'm irritable and I can't drive my kids to carpool or whatever. I mean, I carry on. And my physical symptoms frequently can get subsumed by my emotional ones. And the doctor will end up responding to my emotional symptoms and the sore throat can fall into the background. So I think it's important to think about when you go to the doctor, how you describe your symptoms. And not that you shouldn't tell your doctors how you feel, because of course you should. But by the same token, be careful that you also remember to list your physical symptoms and don't get caught up in your own story. That's important there.
Okay. Yeah. And like you had mentioned in the past, just making sure you write everything down, because so many times, and I fall into this myself, I go to the doctor, I think like I've got these five things I want to talk about. And then after I leave, I'm like, darn it, I forgot to mention this thing.
Right. Exactly. Oh, I do that all the time.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
In fact, you think it's like one of the most important things.
Well, my kids, somebody always comes with me now when I go to the doctor because I start to talk and I like people. So I want to know all about him and I'll forget, you know, that I'm there for a reason. And then I go, oh, when I get out, oh, I forgot this. I forgot that, you know. It's very funny, but it isn't. It's serious. It could be serious.
Yeah, most definitely. Is there any other thing that you want to make sure that we understand when it comes to our own health and healthcare and how we should go about speaking to our doctors?
I'll tell you the thing that actually surprised me the most as I was doing all these interviews is, and I'm not guilty of this. I don't know how many of your listeners are, but so many of the women I talked with were so ashamed about being ill, but they felt embarrassed that they were sick. And it turned out that so many of them blamed their illness on stress, and they felt that they felt that their stress meant that they couldn't manage their lives. So that when they got sick, they felt that their illness was almost like a public announcement. Look, I can't manage my life. That's why I'm sick. And that resulted in their hesitation. They didn't call the doctor because they were sure the doctor had patients who were, people can't see my quotes, but who were really sick, sicker than they were, and they didn't want to embarrass themselves or the doctors. So I think that shame is something to be really aware of. I think what's important is when we are ill, so many of us forget about just how random illness can be. I mean, think about it. Some people get COVID, some don't. Some alcoholics get liver disease, some don't. Some people that die from lung cancer never smoked a day in their life. I mean, it just depends. It can be, certainly self-care is important, but it also is good luck and good genes, good environment.
Right.
So I think that those things are really important to remember. And it certainly stress does contribute to illness, but it isn't the necessarily rather the only cause.
Right. Yeah, I think it's there's so much at play with all of it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And there's just, you know, in the book, I tell the story of my father-in-law, who never exercised a day in his life, ate nothing but red meat, loathed vegetables, I mean, did everything wrong, died at 84 or 5, and his blood pressure was lower than mine even dreams of being. So, you know, there you go.
He was probably living the life, right?
I mean, truly, and I do everything right. And, you know, I'm on blood pressure medication. Go figure. You know? It's unfair, but there it is. It hurts me to say it. Well, and we were talking earlier about, I mean, I exercise, I eat right, I do it all, you know.
Right.
A lot of good it did me.
No.
But it did do me good. I shouldn't say that, because it did. Yes. I'm very healthy for my age, except for my blood pressure.
Okay. Well, let us know where we can find you and the title of your book and where we can find the book.
Okay. You can find me at SusanSalinger.com. That's SalenGer. Title of the book is called Sideline: How Women Manage and Mismanage Their Health. And it's on Amazon. It's anywhere you buy books. They either carry it or they'll order it for you.
Okay. And I'll make sure everything's in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
And then also, if you could leave our listeners with one thing that they could do this week to help them either live a healthier life or raise children or children to live a healthier life, what would that be?
I would say to remember as frequently as you can that it's your body and your life and you're in charge of it. I know with little kids, I mean, you know, I've had them too. It's really hard to find the time to do some self-care and to take care of yourself by your body and your head, you know? And I think that it's really important, if you possibly can, to find some time for yourself, whether it's 5 minutes every day or an hour a week. It doesn't matter how you do it. But you come first, and your body comes first, and it's yours, the only one you're going to get. So take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And know, I'm going to add on to this, like, and, you know, understand that this goes with your doctor visits and everything, that you are the deciding factor with all of it.
Right. In fact, one thing that to do this week, which is what you said, is think about when was the last time you had a mammogram? When was the last time you had a colonoscopy, depending on your age? I mean, look, make sure you're doing everything preventively that you need to do so that you can take care of your family in a much more effective way, perhaps, than if you don't feel well.
And if you're listening when this comes out, it's summertime, so making sure to take the time now that you have a little extra time, possibly, and schedule those appointments.
Right. And I know you have fitness classes too, and exercise. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to add this on. This is not something you can do, like you said, exactly today. But I am 80 years old. I have no health problems other than high blood pressure, which, you know, is genetic, in my case anyway. And I've exercised for 40 years, and I have to tell you, I mean, I hate it. Let me be really clear about that. I'm not one of those people who live to go to the gym. I don't have endorphins, I'm convinced. But I do it, and I think it has really paid off. And that is a really concrete tip. If you can find the time, you don't have to have the desire, because I don't have the desire. You have to have the discipline. They're two different things.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's really, I know you'll agree, because you have, you know, you do personal training, but do you have health problems, or has your exercise helped you as well?
I don't have any health problems as of yet.
Yeah. Good for you. I mean, I'm convinced. I can tell, I know by the way I move compared to some of the people I know. If you saw me walk, you wouldn't know I was 80. I mean, you really wouldn't.
Right.
I have a huge energy level, and it's just, yeah, I mean, part of it's genetics and luck, but I think a large part of it is weightlifting, Pilates, the whole thing.
Movement. I mean, movement is huge. Mm-hmm. That's one thing I'm very big on. Not so much even just, I, you know, I love exercise. I obviously, my business is exercise, but just moving on the whole, just keeping your body moving can help so much.
Yes. Sitting is one of the worst things you can do, as I've been reading about that.
Yeah.
In fact, if anybody's interested, go to my other website, Rama.Gains, G-A-I-N-S, and see what I can do. And I mean, you'll be impressed, meaning that you can do it too. It's not about me. It's about what all of you guys can do.
I'm going to take a look at it. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your day for this conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for taking the time out of your day to listen to our podcast. We hope you found this information valuable and can incorporate it into your family's life. Make sure to check out our show notes for all the important links available. Come join us on Facebook at Moms Raising Healthy Humans community page. Also, please check out our wide range of memberships, family monthly focus ideas, challenges, live events, and on-demand and live workouts, meal plans, and so much more. Head to formfitonline.com. And as always, keep moving.